right, so we are here in the studio with Imani Brown, here to speak to us about Prospect 3 and many other things. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, good to be here.
Yeah. So first of all, tell us what Prospect 3 is for people who may not have heard of it.
Well, Prospect 3 is the third iteration of Prospect New Orleans, which is a citywide exhibition of contemporary art. We had Prospect 1 in 2008, then Prospect 2, and now we're on Prospect 3, and we've got 58 artists from all around the world who are dispersed around 18 different venues, some off-site projects, and then countless, like 100 additional P3 Plus projects, which are featured local venues and local artists around the city.
So what was your involvement with Prospect 3 this time?
Well, I started as the manager of publications, and I put together the two catalogs, one for the show Basquiat and the Bayou, and the other general catalog for P3, and now I'm the curatorial associate as well. So the way I sort of see it, more than just general curating or beyond general curating, I'm sort of helping to make some of the more impossible and unwieldy projects come into fruition.
Hmm. So what made you interested to get involved?
In Prospect? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm from New Orleans, and I left after I evacuated for the storm and finished up my high school up in Maryland, and then went to college in New York and stayed there for a while. And, you know, New York starts to wear on you. You start to really appreciate the specialness of New Orleans when you're in New York for a while. So I was sort of yearning to come back, and P3 was a great opportunity. And I was meeting with Brooke Davis Anderson, our director, up in New York. She's based there. And Ilva Rouse, when I would come home, she's our deputy director for curatorial affairs. And I liked them, and I felt that I could trust them. And I just put myself completely on the table. They knew who I was. They knew my politics, where my mind was around art and ethics, and they gave it right back to me, and I felt comfortable working with them.
Were you able to experience Prospect 1 and 2?
You know, I actually wasn't. I was in New York, and I really only came home for the holidays, and I never saw it. I never saw either of them, I have to say.
But I know this one is kind of different from the other two. What makes it different?
Well, our artistic director is new. This is the first time that the biennial is curated by someone other than Dan Cameron, and Franklin Sermons is just a complete dream. He's fantastic. He's brilliant. He's a very heartfelt person, and he's got a vision, and I think his vision has driven Prospect 3 into something beyond what it's ever been. First of all, and I think it's always sort of important to say without using it as some sort of propagandistic, you know, medium, but it's I think it's a pretty historic moment. 44 of the 58 artists in this biennial are artists of color from around the world, from all backgrounds, 22 of whom are African-American. So for the art world, which is overwhelmingly 93% of European descent, for both visitors, artists who are actually shown.
Well, this is legitimate. I must say that's legitimized art world or mainstream or however you want
to call it.
Exactly.
So art there world are plenty in heavy of air quotes.
People, yeah. I have to lift up all of those people that are performing art and are doing their art outside of those numbers.
That's definitely for sure. When I say art world, I really mean the world that, the sort of self-defined art world that has conceived itself as the mainstream, mm-hmm. that gets shown in the blockbuster museums around the country, like the MoMA, the LACMA, the Guggenheim, right. and around the world. But really the only time that there's been that, as far as I've heard, and without myself having done extensive research, but what people have said is that the only thing really comparable to this biennial as far as the diverse representation of artistic visions has been the maybe 1989 Havana Biennial.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So you spoke a little bit about that you laid out your political and, you know, all of your views to the thing, and I'm just curious how that manifested in Prospect 3 today.
Well, I worked for another arts organization in New York, and it was really interesting. It was my first job after college, but it sort of, I was able to just jump right into, again, this quote-unquote art world, which is sort of totalistic in New York, and working for a nonprofit, but a nonprofit that was attached to a for-profit gallery. So I got a little bit of both worlds. I got the sort of chaos of the nonprofit sphere, and then also the hyper commodification of art that occurs in the for-profit sphere. And I didn't really want either of those things. You know, nonprofits are notorious for poor management, and that, you know, just not the administrators just really not looking out for the best of their employees, or not being able to. And the fact that, you know, I felt really close to both of the people who would be my superiors was really important. And they had a lot of experience, you know, working in alternative art practices. Brooke was the director of contemporary art at the Folk Art Museum for, I believe, 11 years in New York. And that was really interesting to me, that she didn't just come out of the mainstream art practice.
So what would you say your politics around the ethics of art are? Because I think that's what you were kind of...
Yeah, well, yeah, so again, this commodification of art is something that's really concerning to me. I think it's bankrupting our culture, which is a political vehicle. I don't think that that's accidental without going, you know...
When you say our culture, though, what do you mean by it? Whose culture is our culture?
Well, I think anyone's culture, really. And what, you know, you're seeing in... the art world is or in art in general, is people expressing their, you know, their personal and collective situation, how they stand, you know, with regard to their experiences, with regard to their family, their whatever they see as their identity, however they identify and what their place is. So they're trying to navigate that world. Their place might be a position of political marginality. You might be a Palestinian artist who is trying to make statements and or explore and maybe express to the world, but also just explore for themselves what it means to be a Palestinian within a world that, you know, is not giving them the support that they need. That's not coming down hard on the apartheid state that's repressing their people. So a Palestinian artist, you know, will be exploring that realm. So that might be a culture that they're exploring. An African-American artist has a different perspective. When you start to take the objects and the gestures that are created from within this mode, when someone's sort of trying to navigate their position within the world, and you place them on the marketplace and you assign a value to them, and you put the artist in this realm where they're constantly trying to make a living and survive, you know, from their art, or maybe not, maybe they have a part-time job, but, you know, their gallery is putting pressure on them that they have to sell their work, they have to go to an art fair, there are, you know, hundreds of art fairs around the country and around the world that you're constantly having to churn out marketable objects, marketable goods for. You become, you know, artists are workers as well, and your labor becomes exploited.
So it sounds like they become part of the rest of capitalism.
Oh, for sure. The, you know, artists today are, it's funny, right? Because, you know, you usually think of an artist as someone who is somehow outside of that, you know, capitalistic
realm. I think the
term
is used very elitistly, artist. I think that, like, one of the things that it removes from us is that we all, like, have an artist core to us. We all have, like, some way to express ourselves. And I think that the way in which the term is applied, it usually is in that specified forms of labor in which people can recognize the art in it, and not like, oh, look at the way in which that person's walking down the street, or the way they're carrying themselves, the ways they just move throughout the world is artistic. So I just want to lift that up a little bit. And also, but before you continue what you're saying, I wanted to throw in, let's go back to looking at Prospect 3 a little bit more and getting some of the specifics around what some of the installations and venues and, you know, who are some of the artists, all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah, well, we have a lot of really interesting projects that all have a very sort of political bent, socio-political bent. I don't really separate politics from the social realm, you know, myself, because it's part of life, you mm-hmm. know. All art is political because everything is political. But some of the artists who are working within Prospects 3 include Mary Ellen Carroll, who is based between Houston and New York, and she has a really interesting project. She's working with this new technology called Super Wi-Fi that is essentially Wi-Fi signals run along a television wavelength, which allows the Wi-Fi signals to travel up to 2 kilometers without being impeded, which means that you have free public broadband over the span of 2 kilometers, and that's per node. So what Mary Ellen Carroll is proposing, so her work for P3 is sort of exploring and developing this proposal for the city, is to place these super Wi-Fi nodes along Claiborne overpass from all the way, you know, from Holly Grove out to the floodplains through mm-hmm. Central City, through the east. And the way she sees it is really interesting to me. It's bringing renewed visibility to a community and the number of communities that have been rendered invisible by this hyper-visual, what I call a sort of brutalist class structure, the Claiborne Overpass. Of course, you know, we know that the Claiborne Corridor was destroyed in the 60s by the construction of the Robert Moses Lovechild Claiborne Overpass, I-10. And it was once known as the front yard of the African American community, very important cultural grounds. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, it was all the historic oaks were dug up and this concrete behemoth was placed down.
Yeah, the overpass tactic is one that has been used over and over by structural racists to destroy black communities.
For sure.
So you just need to look in the American history books, and or not in the American history books, cause you might have to search the internet, actually.
There's it's interesting. I mean, there were.
Where is that piece? Like, is it something to be seen? Or?
It's something to be seen, yeah. So her explorations are at the AIA, the Architecture Institute of America, at 1000 St. Charles on Lee Circle. Mm-hmm. And so this is a long-term project that she's going to be working on for years. And that's something else that's really interesting about P3 is that rather than just being, you know, this project that descends on New Orleans and squats here for a couple months before flying off again, it's really starting to look to put down roots and start to create long-term projects that are really engaging deeply with issues here in New Orleans and trying to work through them rather than simply comment on them, which is something that art does. It's looking to use art as a force of social change.
What is the long-term plan for, I mean, what's the goal of something like Prospect 3 and what is the plan going into the future?
Well, I think the initial goal was to assist with the, I don't want to call it the rebuilding effort, but, you know, assist the city as it was getting back on its feet after the storm to bring a burst of inspiration from around the world. I understand there was some criticism around the first one that it wasn't engaging deeply enough with local artists. And, you know, I'm not sure why that was. I'm not sure if it's that P1 felt that, you know, there weren't enough local artists who were back to engage with. I know that they engaged with some, or maybe they were just trying to bring inspiration from beyond. But whatever the case may be, Prospect has learned and has listened to the city and has responded. And I feel like P3 is a very different organization than P1 initially was. And so now, like I said, we're really looking to put down roots. P3 has, you know, used a local PR firm, which I think is really important. You know, initially we had this New York office, and then the New Orleans office was sort of the satellite office, and now it's reversed. Now the New Orleans office is the main office, and New York is Brooke and Elizabeth Baraboo, our development manager, you know, where the money's at. So we've got development up there. So New York is now the satellite office. And so it's slowly starting to put all of its, you know, resources here in New Orleans. And I think that's great. And I think it'll be helpful for developing the visual arts infrastructure here in New Orleans. We, of course, have a very, very fluent performance and music-based and, you know, other forms of cultural institutions just entrenched here and well-supported. But, you know, it's my personal opinion that visual arts, you know, isn't as, you know, developed as far as in institutions go. So it'll be helpful. I think the one... you know, I always have a but that's, you know, attached to whatever I say. And my one caution would be to just make sure that we're not replicating exactly these capitalistic forms that are sort of parasitic in places like New York and L.A. and making sure we're bringing the best of contemporary art to New Orleans, contemporary art and all of the, you know, mechanisms that work around it.
The best, of course, being subjective, it being art and all.
No, not the best as in what type of art. I mean the best practices, okay. i.e. not labor exploitation, i.e. not the hyper European point of view, i.e. you know, exactly what P3 is doing, engaging deeper with the community, you know, the communities within New Orleans. I think that's something we can do better. I think we can, you know, continue to do outreach. I think we need to be speaking to schools. We have a program actually called P3 Rights that is bringing in local high school students and middle school students and teaching them in art writing and art criticism. And we're going to ask them to actually critique P3 when they're done with the program. So all of these different initiatives to really make sure that we are, you know, making sure that the population of New Orleans knows that P3, that Prospect, because there will be a Prospect 4, but that Prospect is for them. It's not just something that was brought here for tourists or for a certain population of New Orleans to engage with. It is for the city, and it's up to us. You know, if we want New Orleans to accept us, we have to go to the people of New Orleans. New Orleans, you know, we know New Orleans, you know, won't come to you. People have their, you know, their haunts and they have their routines, and that's what they do. And if you want to engage with that, you have to go to where they're, you know, living. And I think that's great. It's what makes the city beautiful, and Prospect is starting to learn that, and so we're coming along.
Yeah, what are some other must-sees?
Well, I have to say, all right, so I've got a couple. Mary Ellen's is sort of the one that is my sort of best hope for the future. I think the one that really just pulls at my heart and overwhelm me with emotion is the Propeller Group and Christopher Myers' project on St. Claude and St. Rock, the UNO St. Claude Gallery. So the Propeller Group is a collective based in Saigon, Vietnam, and LA, and Chris Myers is from New York, and they collaborated on this project. So it's pretty impossible to sort of explain because it's beyond words, but there is a second line culture in Vietnam, and so the Propeller Group wanted to reflect on that from the vantage point of New Orleans, and they are looking into some of the funeral traditions and the what I see as a sort of play with death that, you know, we have here in New Orleans as well. We're celebrating the life of the deceased, you know, reinforcing the vitality of the living. They have something very similar with the brass band as well in New Orleans, in Vietnam, and the sort of pilgrimage, roving, you know, walk that they do, and other elements come in that we don't have here. I don't really want to give too much away because it's pretty mind-blowing when you see it for the first time, but all of these sort of flirtations with death and walking this fine line between the realms of the living and the dead. The work is called The Living Need Light and the Dead Need Music.
Is it a video?
It's, yeah. it's a video installation, and Chris Myers has created some hybrid musical sculptures that are used as well within the film, and they're featured in the space.
Cool.
One other project that is really close to me is Lisa Siegel's project, Home Court Crawl, which is also really interesting. So Lisa is an artist based out of New York, and her practice revolves around seeing architecture, the way that we as individuals engage with, you know, these massive structures that both bring us together and divide us. To just ground her work, one of the pieces that she did was something called Line Up in New York. And in the Bowery, there is this museum called the New Museum. And it's, you know, typical, you know, art world institution, you know, same 93% white population, you know, upper middle class, upper class attendees, you know, high entrance fee, et cetera. And it's directly adjacent to the Bowery Mission, which is a, you know, it's the mission. It's support for homeless and the downtrodden. And neither the twain shall meet. You know, the people who go to the Bowery do not go to the New Museum. The people who go to the New Museum do not go. They avoid the Bowery as much as possible, although the neighborhood is, you know, changing rapidly. And so Lisa wanted to, in a very sort of like simple gesture, wanted to connect the two structures. So what she did was paint a line over the facades of the buildings, connecting the New Museum with the Bowery Mission. And then she continued that line. So literally painting the line using paint, using fabric, this teal bright stripe going across the buildings throughout New York. And there's this great photograph where you can actually see it snaking across the city. Mm. And then she extended that line and continued it up into Asia and through some countries over there. So that was really interesting. So here in New Orleans, she wanted to, again, engage with architecture. And she was really, you know, taken aback by the number of blighted structures we have in our city. We know we've got upwards of 40,000 blighted properties, homes, schools, etc. She just found it really baffling and heartbreaking and troubling because, of course, the largest concentrations of these blighted properties are within neighborhoods of color and neighborhoods that have working class residents. And she wondered why. And she wondered why nothing's being done and how we have such a large homeless population and all of these empty homes and how, you know, we have a need for all of these, you know, as any population does, a need for many social services, after school programs, et cetera, and all of these empty, rotting structures, beautiful, historic structures. So she wanted to ask the, you know, population of New Orleans to sort of re-see these structures, not for their tragic value, but for their potential. So she took the lines of a series of plays by artist Susan Laurie Parks, and she painted them on Tyvek using Mystic Blue signs over on Magazine. Mm-hmm. And Eve did a beautiful job. And she wheat-pasted the Tyvek plays on the facades of these clusters of blighted properties in three neighborhoods in Mid-City, just above Claiborne. So like Conti and North Roman, 323 North Roman is the first house. Holly Grove, kind of situated around Oleander and Holly Grove and Hamilton, St. Rock. And she's sort of, you know, the plays are, there are three plays. There's one called Empty in Holly Grove, which is very minimalistic, just two people talking. They're all very vernacular, usually two people talking to each other, looking out around the world. And so Empty is two people just thinking about emptiness and empty abandoned property. But one of the lines is, you know, anything can happen here, right? Because nothing is happening here. And so each line is on a different house. And so you're walking from house to house and you're piecing together this fragmented narrative and you're reconnecting this fragmented community that's been broken by neglect.
Mm. Yeah, it reminds me of the what they've done with some of the blighted properties in Detroit. I don't know if you've I can't remember what the name of that.
The Heidelberg,
Heidelberg Project.
That's what it's called, yes.
Yeah, and isn't there also something going on in New Orleans with a lot of art on buildings somewhere?
There's Brandon Odoms' project, Exhibit B, out on in the West Bank in Algiers. I actually haven't been out to see it yet, which is really sad. I work on Saturdays, so that's when it's open. But I'll have to bounce out there with him at some point. But, you know, Brandon's a really brilliant guy, and he is beyond brilliant. He has a really good heart, and he has, as well, he has a vision which is super important. You know, y'all, did y'all get to see Project B?
I didn't.
We all, yeah, I was hoping you could tell us more.
Well, so Project B was this project that he worked on last year. I actually only saw it after it had been shuttered, and I only got to go into one building. But essentially, he went into the abandoned Florida projects, which were owned by Hano, the Housing Authority of New Orleans. And Hano had just left them open, abandoned, you know, open to the elements for 8 years. And huge blight on the community, huge, like, as with any blighted property, safety hazard, psychological hazard, you know. And so Brandon went in there and he started painting. And he started painting, you know, portraits of people who inspired him. So Frederick Douglass, Martin Luther King and Coretta, Malcolm X, Bob Marley, you know, all sorts of people. And basically black power figures, as you saw, Maya Angelou, Nina Simone, and, you know, people started coming by and seeing it and being inspired, and so he painted in total 30 rooms, and then other folk came by and started painting and creating installations, and eventually 70 rooms were taken over by art. Music videos were happening, you know, people were coming to see it. It was spontaneous. It was beautiful. Hano sort of turned a blind eye until it started to get international attention. And then they were like, ooh, this looks bad. You know, now everyone knows that we neglected this building for 8 years. So rather than try to work with Brandon and, you know, see it as an opportunity to utilize the powerful work there, they decided to shutter the whole thing. They said it was, you know, a safety hazard that people are going in this building. And so they put these iron gates on all the doors and windows. Hey, and they remain locked today. And so I was working initially with Brandon to try to ask Hano to open the buildings for at least one day, you know, like give us some closure. The buildings are always been have always been slated for demolition. And that's cool. Brandon's always been cool with that because, you know, it's a site-specific work. They were meant for that place and that time, and they don't need to be preserved, you know. They, when the buildings go down, they should go with them, and they should build some housing there. Yeah, so we couldn't get it open. So he started, he went to the West Bank, and he lives in Algiers, but he, like, you know, found this, there's this other huge, you know, I think, like, 300-something acre, I don't really know how large an acre is, so... But it was this large, big apartment complex, really kind of like interesting, you know, that Soviet block style architecture. But the buildings were initially constructed in the 60s as middle class housing for white folk. And they're so they're, you know, the architecture isn't that like really brutalist, kind of depressing socialist stripe. It's more of the, like, you know, clean modernist forms. But anyway, so he was painting over there and, you know, doing his thing. There's this really interesting structure in the center of this complex that is looks almost like a it was probably a community center, but it looks like a temple of some sort, and he was painting in there. And this guy Bill comes up. It's like, what are you doing? And Brandon's like, oh, you know. And guy Bill says, you know, are you making a movie? And Brandon said, no, I'm just painting. And he's like, is this your work? And Brandon said, yes. And Bill said, it's incredible. And they started talking. He was like, what do you need? You know, like the whole thing is like falling apart, you know. So he's on this in this two-story structure. There are no ledges. There's just a drop down, you know. If he were to fall, he would fall two stories. So he's like, you know, I'll put a beam across all these windows. Do you need extra drywall? There's this, you know, scaffolding support beam in the middle that was just raw, kind of rusting metal. He's like, I'll put some drywall up there. And Brandon's like, no, it's not necessary. No, no. And Brandon comes back the next time. And of course, there are beams, you know, in the windows, and he's put up drywall. And so Bill really wanted to work with Brandon. He was like, you know, we should do something big. And so Brandon had this idea of, you know, just painting the whole, and graffiti artists have been going there and painting and doing tags and stuff like that, but he wanted to really do something big and invite a bunch of graffiti artists in from around the city to do monumental works on all the buildings. And so Bill supported it. And
Did Bill own the building?
Bill is, I'm not entirely sure. He's in the process of purchasing the building.
Okay.
So what Brandon ended up finding out, which is really interesting, is he started to find out the paper trail for these buildings and the history. And so that's what really shaped the final conception of what to do a few months ago with this project. So he found out, as I said, the buildings were initially constructed for middle-class housing. At some point, I believe in the 70s, a couple of Saints players moved in, and there was white flight. And slowly, the demographics shifted, as was happening all around the country, you know, as you mentioned. And it became an all-black complex. There had been a pool, you know, pool was eventually abandoned. The buildings went through this long process of deterioration, of shifting from manager to manager. And before Katrina, ooh, should I name names? I won't name names.
Well,
the buildings before Katrina were owned by Reginelli of Reginelli Pizza. Mm-hmm. And
hey, if there's a paper trail, people can look this up. So if it's true, it's true.
Oh, exactly. No, please. And Brandon would always like to preface it by saying, you know, this is what, you know, he heard from someone without having done his due diligence research. So this is like hearsay of hearsay. But this
Thank
is
you for
who,
at least putting that out there.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to put it out there. But this is what, you know, one of the people who was involved in trying to purchase the building said. And so anyway, so Reginelli owned the building after the storm. You know, the building just started to rapidly deteriorate. You'll go up there now and it's just, you know, everything is just open. I mean, it's like it's concrete structure, so it's not going to rot. But I mean, it was pretty raw. It was pretty barren. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so Common Ground tried to purchase after the storm, Common Ground went in and started doing all of these different programs, a free clinic, you know, food programs, this, that, mm-hmm. and the other. And they wanted to buy the building from Reginelli. Reginelli was down with the deal, and apparently the city crushed the deal, didn't want the building to be transferred into their hands. Mm. And so Reginelli ended up selling it to an organization called the Johnson Corporation, who evicted everyone on Thanksgiving Day. And then the building was just empty for several years, and Bill came in, and he is actually looking to retain some of the structures, but he wants to build a giant sports complex on the property. So that is more to be continued.
All right, we're going to just take a quick break, and we will be back with Amani.
We're back with Amani Brown speaking about Prospect 3 and a bunch of exciting things. We're just talking about Prospect B.
Exhibit B. Oh, and I realized why you thought my name was Imani Gray. You're probably thinking of Kimani Gray. Mm. So, I don't know. That got me thinking. Last night I went to hear the lawyer for Mike Brown and Trayvon Martin speak at Dillard University. Mm-hmm. Which was very moving. You know, there's a lot of action going on in New Orleans these days around the killing and non-trial for the murder of Mike Brown. And I don't know, maybe we want to remind some folk about some actions happening.
I don't know about anything that's coming. Well, actually, you know what? Were you there on Sunday?
No, I wasn't. I was sick on Sunday.
Oh, okay. I did see the thing for yesterday, the talk, and I would have actually loved to have somebody. We would have known you were going. We would have said tape it so that the listeners could experience it as well. On Sunday, they did. That's a good point to bring up. On Sunday, they did talk about future actions. I think that they said there was going to be space holding done at Lee Circle.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say Friday. I want to say like or it might be like every day at 9, yeah. 9 p.m.
At Congo Square, I thought.
Congo Square, thank you. Yeah. Thank you, it's Congo Square.
Yeah. Do you know?
No, I don't know for sure.
Yeah. Well, I did also want to ask you about, you said there's some other project you were working on.
Oh, yeah. So I'm working on this project called Blights Out, which is the sort of a continuation of Lisa Siegel's project, Home Court Crawl. It's a marriage between that project and some ideas of Carl Joe Williams, who is a local artist and a P3 Plus participant at like three different venues, including the Joan Mitchell Center on Rampart, 1000 Rampart. So Carl inherited this project called Blights Out, which was initially a vision to paint doors and windows on the facades of blighted houses. Someone didn't have time to continue the project and offered it to Carl, said, hey, are you interested in this? And Carl thought about it and, you know, went around and looked at houses, like, well, you know, I do want to do something about blight, but I don't want to just paint on the facades. I want to actually transform them somehow and return them to the community. So he got in touch with Prospect and partnered up with Lisa Siegel. And then I got involved, and the three of us are working on purchasing a blighted property collectively in conjunction with the Mid-City community, the neighborhood around where Lisa's mid-city iteration of Home Court Crawl is. We want to establish the property as a community land trust, which means that essentially it's a nonprofit institution that will own land in order to keep the land affordable and keep property values stable. So, you know, a community land trust can own multiple lots, multiple properties, and individuals can then build homes or businesses and own the structure on top of the land, and they can pass that structure down from generation to generation. But if they ever decide that they want to move and sell the property, the land trust would have right of first refusal to buy the property back and would pay the structure, the property owner, for improvements made to the property, but the land value wouldn't increase, which is land is what really drives property values up. So the point would be that there would be permanently affordable property, whether for housing or for small businesses or nonprofits, et cetera. So we want to sort of get that process started by seeding one community, one property as a community land trust that would serve as a cultural programming space, looking at the political nature of New Orleans's culture, Second Line, Social Aid and Pleasure Club as a mutual aid society, and also serving as a resource center. So we would document our process as we navigate all the red tape and bureaucracy to try to buy property and rebuild it. It will be, we'll turn it into a toolkit and pass it on to other folks so that people can say, hey, you know, I want to own my own house. I want to start a small business. I want to build a community land trust in my neighborhood. Here's how you do it.
Mm-hmm. Are you using any models that are previously existing? Because, you know, it's not completely building the wheel, but you're doing something special here.
No, of course it's not. Rebuilding the wheel. We are certainly inspired by a lot of projects. Carl's initial inspiration was the Astor Gates's Dorchester projects and Rebuild Foundation. Of course, the Heidelberg projects are a great way to transform blight into something that is inspiring. Project Row Houses down in Houston, Rick Lowe's project. Rick Lowe just got the MacArthur Grant for that work. But I think what is different about this project from all of the other projects is specifically this community land trust element, the fact that it's, you know, not just working from, you know, like Project Row Houses and Dorchester projects are nonprofit, you know, institutions that take blighted property and offer them to people to use for exhibition space, for community space, for job training programs, support groups for young mothers, you know, this, that, and the other. We really want the community to take over this project. And, you know, I don't even mean take over because that, you know, also sounds like, you know, well, we're, you know, we're going to get it started and you can have it. But we're working directly in conjunction with the residents of this neighborhood, and they have full ownership of the project from the beginning. And that's what's super important for the vision to be conceived with the people who will be utilizing the space from the beginning.
Right. So we just have one more minute, and then we're going to have Pastor Webster come on to speak to us about the millage. But is there anything else? Yeah, you can stay for that conversation as well. But if there's anything else you wanted to add about Prospect 3 or what the community needs to know to check it out. I mean, is there maps available, or how do people?
Yeah, for sure. We have mapping guides available at the Contemporary Arts Center, which is our hub. And that's located at 900 Camp Street. We also have mapping guides at every one of our 18 venues. So you can pick those up. They're, you know, a hot pink newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
Not hard to miss.